Disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find out more about us and our work at www.deadsoulspodcast.com or over on Instagram by searching our name. As always, thank you for joining us. What happens when the most horrific crime turns a normal and cozy family home into the location of a notoriously dark and macabre address? Does bad energy really linger at places that hold a dark past? Can negativity be anchored to a specific location over time? In May 2023, I became a dark tourist and visited some of the UK's most infamous locations, some of the worst sites of murder and criminality in the British Isles. Tonight, I share what I found. I am not sure what I expected to feel standing in the street outside of what was number 25 Cromwell Street in Gloucester. The house that stood here, the House of Horrors as the press dubbed it back in 1994, was demolished soon after the incarceration of its notorious inhabitants, Fred and Rose West. In its place sits a garden thoroughfare, a completely unassuming and peaceful addition to a street which displays no signs of its horrifying past. "It did have a sign, a memorial to all the victims," says Derek, who's 69. He spots me taking a photograph of the notorious street sign and walks over for a chat. "But it got stolen by people like you." "Like me," I thought. "And what am I?" "How do you mean?" I said. "Like me." "The weirdos who come to gawk at where the house was and take pictures. I don't understand it." It's a pretty abrupt and rude welcome, but I kind of expected that, or worse to be honest, from any locals that I ran into. After a few minutes of talking though, we warmed to each other, I think. He was actually a really nice man. I tell him that I'm not really a gawker, as he initially called me, and that I'm a researcher for a podcast on dark history, and I'm researching a piece on those very folks he made reference to. "Yeah, we get them too, from all over the world." He means people from the media. He tells me that he has spoken with the BBC, Channel 4 and Sky TV from the UK, and also television reporters from the United States, Canada, Germany, Japan, Australia, and loads more. Netflix are the latest people to come around filming, he says. They all ask the same sort of things and try to be respectful, but if they really wanted to be respectful, they wouldn't come here at all. They would let it be, Derek continues. "It's a fairly significant element of UK history, though," I try to explain to him. "I appreciate it's not necessarily a positive part of history, but it's history nevertheless. Also, don't you think it's important that we talk about these things so that we can understand how they happened and to ensure that they don't happen again? So that we can essentially learn from them," I went on, probably in vain. "A load of old bollocks," he replies. "Those sickos will always be around. We can't second-guess people and prevent it. Society is a cesspool now, not like it used to be." I remind him that Fred West started his crimes back in the late 60s, at a time like it used to be. But Derek changes the subject and asks where I've travelled from instead. During my visit in May, it felt as if a little had changed since the crimes happened throughout the 70s and 80s. They were the same rundown Victorian-era houses with tired grey exteriors and a shabby, unkempt feel. All in all, the street is pretty miserable, although entirely unassuming. Derek tells me that the memorial walkway garden that now sits where the House of Horrors once was is generally only used now by druggies, pretty much confirming my thoughts about the neighbourhood. The history of 25 Cromwell Street is as grim as the street's appearance. On the 24th of February 1994, police executed a search warrant on the Cromwell Street property owned by the Wests. They were searching for the body of the West's missing daughter, Heather, who the police suspected had been killed by Fred and buried in the back garden of the property. The police found Heather's body the following day. They weren't, however, expecting to find a further 8 bodies also buried at Cromwell Street. In total, police would find 12 bodies at Cromwell Street, and even more at a number of previous addresses which Fred West had lived at. He, along with his wife Rose, are suspected of killing several others too, additional victims, whose bodies have never been located. Around 30 murders to be exact. Fred admitted as much to his appropriate adult and the police back in 1994. To clarify for our listeners outside of the UK, an appropriate adult is an individual assigned to safeguard the interests, rights, entitlements and welfare of children and vulnerable adults who are suspected of a criminal offence. They ensure that the accused are treated in a fair and just manner and are able to participate effectively. Appropriate adults do not work for the police and are usually a relative or carer, social worker, community care coordinator, or independent trained appropriate adult, or a reasonable person over the age of 18 who is not employed or affiliated with the police. The accused has the right to choose their appropriate adult. I thought that was worth clarifying. Fred West had learning difficulties and a low IQ, potentially following a significant head injury he sustained as a teenager. These are the reasons he was deemed in need of an appropriate adult to support him during police questioning. I take some more photographs of Cromwell Street, and I'm just about ready to leave when Derek drops the bombshell. Yeah, I knew Fred pretty well back in the day. Okay, so Derek now has my full attention. Tell me more, what was he like? I asked. He was a bit drippy, everyone around here knew him. She was horrible. But Fred, he was really friendly. He was a nice guy, actually. Interesting words there, Derek. Her, in his statement, is a reference to Rose. I've read that she could be quite cold and snappy, shall we say. A few years ago, I became acquaintances with a lady who spent some time in prison with Rose West in the 1990s. She enjoyed telling me how much she and most of the other prisoners hated Rose. She had cold eyes and a resting bitch face. The cow was pure evil and you could see it, to quote my friend, whom I won't name here. Quickly and to clarify, Fred and Rose West were a middle-aged married couple that raped, tortured, assaulted and murdered young women between 1967 and 1987. Their depravity, callousness and sheer evil behaviours are notorious in the United Kingdom and the world over. Just reading about what the couple did to their victims will send a shiver down your spine and a grimy feeling of filth over you. The story is pure grime, sludge, grit and filth. Depraved sexual torture from a twisted couple on a level rarely seen in history. Fred committed suicide on New Year's Day in 1995 at Her Majesty's Prison, Birmingham. Rose remains alive and is incarcerated at Her Majesty's Prison, Newhall in West Yorkshire. She'll never be released. These days, she spends her time knitting and ordering clothing from women's home shopping catalogues. The terrifying crimes of the West were left adrift into Gloucestershire folklore. The house was demolished, local authorities say, due to the sensitive nature of the site, and to avoid sightseers of a dark nature. I am writing this literally as I sit on top of the location of the house. Go figure. I'm not sure what the council had planned actually worked. I'm certainly not the first year either, as I previously mentioned. Residents scowl and frown. Derek is lovely, but I can tell he wouldn't lose sleep if he never met me. Gloucester locals aren't proud of the history of the street, nor embrace it in any way. Why would they? I can't blame them. Some famous crime locations are more candid of the infamy surrounding the locations, and the locals embrace it, usually for financial reasons. A lady emerged from a house opposite the location of the Wests. She walks over to me and Derek. She can tell what's happening. It's sick, she interrupts and tells me. She won't give me a name when I ask. You all come here to stare and rub your hands at where the house used to be. They were evil. No one talks about the victims, she says. I asked her if she knew them too. Yes. And they were weird and creepy even before they were caught. She walks off. She clearly doesn't really want to share much more with me. Derek just chuckles to himself. There is a very strange feel when I stand where the house once was. The street is eerily quiet, even in the middle of the day. It's not the street that's doing that, though. It's my psychological mechanism interpreting the situation and location. I had the same feeling in the Museum of Death in Los Angeles, and on Cielo Drive in LA, on Pine Street in Yonkers, New York, in Amstrad in Austria, Auschwitz concentration camp in Poland, and many, many more. You would be hard-pressed to find a corner of Britain without its own murder house. My extensive travels tells me the same can be said for the United States, Europe, and Australia too. Buildings with notorious histories and dark past that sits within our communities, seemingly demure or timorous, sitting amongst us in our cities, towns, and villages. Some locations, albeit not many, but some become accepted tourist attractions. In the East End of London, there are museums and multiple Jack the Ripper walking and driving tours. Although maybe the passage of time has made this more accessible and acceptable, even though the murders are extremely grotesque in their nature. Serial killer Dennis Nielsen's former flat at Cranley Gardens in London's Muswell Hill sits in a leafy suburban street. The flat would be valued at around £400,000, I'm told, similar to other properties on the road. However, it struggled to fetch more than £250,000 when it was sold at auction in 2015. I took some pictures of the building back in June, and one of the neighbours came out to speak to me. She was pleasant and took a fairly matter-of-fact outlook on what happened a few doors down from her family home. "Yeah, I heard he drugged the men, then chopped them up and flushed the pieces down the drain right there." She pointed to the actual drain where body parts were discovered back in 1983. "That's right, sounds like a charming fellow," I quipped. She appreciated the sarcasm. Regarding the sale of the building, though, no one wanted to live in a house where 12 gay men and male prostitutes were lured to their death back in 1981, and where pieces of their rotting corpses were flushed down the toilet. The murders happened over 40 years ago, but still the dark cloud and chilling feeling hang over the place, at least to me. But I have read fairly deeply into the murders, the neighbours likely less so. To most folk, the very existence of these houses gives shape to a nagging, deep-seated psychological fear that the safety of home is perhaps never really that far from being turned into something terrifying or unreal. The houses are landmarks, reminders that we are never truly safe, that our safe spaces are not really our protected places at all. My own fascination with so-called murder houses and places of true crime, which has led me to visit in over 150 notorious crime scenes across the UK, United States and Europe, began when I was a teenager. I guess I can pin it down to when a kid in my class decided to murder an old man who lived on a farm next to my school building. I knew the kid well. We were good friends for a period of time before he fell in with the so-called wrong crowd. I remember he just vanished from class. He stopped turning up. No one really questioned it. Months later, we found that he had been sent to juvenile detention for murder. Because I knew him so well, I couldn't stop thinking why he did it. What made him do such a horrible thing? Allegedly, him and a friend tried robbing the old man in his own home. When the old man stood up to them, they pushed him to the ground and took turns jumping on the man's chest until he was dead, laughing manically as they took a human's life, for no reason whatsoever, no motive. It's really chilling, and so far removed from the boy I was once friends with. He was once shy, quiet, and really polite. I couldn't understand it. The old man they killed had no family, so his farmhouse stood empty for many years after his death. It was only a 15-minute walk from where I lived, just down a dirt track across the side of a mountain. So it was easy for me to go there, which I did on a few occasions, to just stare at the house, to let my thoughts and emotions flood my psyche. Why? Just why? I've never had answers. The killer was released from jail a few years ago. I suppose I could have reached out to my old friend and asked him why, and got the answers that I wanted. But I chose not to. I wonder what happened to the physical places after the crimes occurred. Were they and could they be the same ever again? Will they ever regain the status of a loving family home? I questioned if people avoided these places. Did they become haunted by the victims? Were the houses torn down or hidden away? It's actually a fairly even balance. Back when I was a teenager, I researched a bunch of places close to where I grew up in sunny South Wales and had my grandfather drive me to each of them. Every kid needs a hobby, right? I quickly learned that the owners of these places fell into two categories. There are those that share your morbid fascination, often inviting you in to check out their house and show you the key crime areas. Then there are those who get angry pretty quick with your presence outside of their property. Respect is always important. One woman, I can recall, became incredibly angry while I photographed the surgery in Hyde, Greater Manchester, where Dr. Harold Shipman had murdered over 250 of his patients before he was apprehended in 1998. She shouted aggressively, threatening to call the police, and even placed her hands on me. She had a family member, though, that was killed by Shipman, and she thought my presence there was utterly awful. I can understand her feelings entirely. I was completely intruding, although not in the way I felt that she thought. I wasn't there out of hero worship or respect of any kind for Shipman. He was a monster. He was utter trash. His crimes were dastardly, and I found him personally diabolical. They were, however, historical. Whether we like it or not, the heinous crimes he committed were part of our past. It's that aspect that I'm interested in. What happened, how it happened, and why it happened. The psychology of the criminals behind the crimes. I think it's important we don't forget or block out these atrocities, as we are destined to repeat them if we do. It's not always easy to explain this while someone is literally screaming emotionally in your face or angrily attacking you. How much do we really know about the buildings that we call home? I knocked on the door of a flat in Camden in North London. A tired and confused man in his late 20s answered. I think I woke him. He was completely unaware that he was living in what was once the so-called Camden Rippers apartment. In early 2003, the British national press descended on the quiet low-rise council estate after police charged a middle-aged man with the murder of three women. Anthony Hardy, who lived in the flat, was given a full-life prison tariff later that same year. Its current occupant, after I filled him in on the crime and the criminal that lived in his flat some 20 years ago, had nothing really to say about the flat, really. He let the information I shared sink in for a while, but didn't seem that fazed by it. Maybe he still wasn't fully awake. He wasn't interested in any more conversation either. There was call by many local residents for the flat to be demolished at the time. That sentiment has worn off by current day standards, however. The idea of someone else living in the small and now forever tainted space was too much for locals to handle back then. I would rather they tear it down, one anonymous local neighbour told the Camden New Journal newspaper in 2004. Others at the time suggested turning the apartment into a permanent shrine to the victims. Camden Council's social housing waiting list was already several thousand long, so demolishing the flats wasn't really feasible or an option. When the apartment was renovated and put back onto the market in 2004, there was no shortage of applicants. It quickly became invisible from the crimes of the disturbed sadist who had once called it home. Some, who now live on the estate, as you can expect, see the enduring fascination as a source of frustration and anger. When I knocked another door of a flat in the same building, an elderly woman shooed me away before I even had the opportunity to mouth the word researcher in her direction. I could understand. On my journey, my inquiries were often dismissed out of hand, or with the caveat that any contribution be kept anonymous, in case others got the wrong idea about the whole thing, of course. Especially once they knew that I was a researcher and my visit was for a podcast. Maybe my approach is all wrong, or maybe it's because they see me as media. One person who doesn't seem to have this issue, though, is a man called Scott Michaels. Hailing originally from Detroit in Michigan, Scott grew up next to one of the most deadly traffic intersections in the state. So Michael states his mother's hobby of creating mosaics from the pieces of shattered auto glass that came from the many car crashes outside his childhood home as the catalyst for his lifetime penchant of collecting artifacts from infamous, tragic, and macabre locations. Scott briefly lived in London in the UK in the late 1990s and was a writer for Channel 4's television show Eurotrash. In 2003, Michaels relocated back to the United States and set up Dearly Departed Tours in Los Angeles, which he operated until 2020. As a tour operator, he took dark tourists to various tragic, macabre, and dark historic locations around the city of LA. Michaels specialized in the Manson family murders and ran a Manson-themed helter-skelter murder tour for over 10 years. As part of Dearly Departed Tours, he also set up a museum of his tragical and macabre artifacts on Santa Monica Boulevard, conveniently located just opposite Hollywood Forever Cemetery, where many of Tinseltown's stars are laid to rest. Ideal for those with an interest in the dead to spend an afternoon after visiting Scott's museum, as I have done on several occasions. A perfectly spent day. In addition, Michaels created and hosted the E! Television Network's Hollywood Death Trip and wrote and produced the full-length documentaries 6 Degrees of Helter Skelter and Dearly Departed 1 and 2. Michaels has appeared on NBC Nightly News, Anderson Cooper 360, Access Hollywood, Zach Bagan's Ghost Adventures, and Anthony Bourdain's The Layover. Scott was the advisor to Quentin Tarantino for the movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Scott is one of the most respectful guys in the dark tourist industry, so to speak, and he regularly raises funds to place gravestones or markers on the graves of forgotten television or movie stars. COVID-19 sadly called an end to Scott's museum and tour company, but Scott has taken his expertise and fascinating stories online with both a fascinating YouTube channel and great podcast. So why am I talking about this Scott Michaels guy so much? Well, everyone, I'm happy and extremely honored to have him here on the phone with me tonight, all the way from Los Angeles. So, Scott, I grew up in the late 80s and 90s, in a world before the internet, where any kind of fascination with dark history and tragic events wasn't really spoken about. Certainly not as much as today with society's fascination with true crime, shall we say. Back then, any research had to be done in the library or by going to locations and speaking with people. When and how did you develop your interest in what I suppose you could call your areas of expertise?
Well, I guess I've seen it up close, not necessarily in a famous sense, but where I grew up, it was kind of a rough neighborhood. And I knew a few people that had been murdered over the years. And I'm not saying that as in, you know, it was just the way it was. It wasn't like, here I am from Detroit, you know, and I'm real tough. It's not like that. It's just the way things were. And also I saw a lot of accidents because we lived on a treacherous corner where traffic accidents happen all the time. So I've seen that kind of stuff up close. So it didn't really freak me out. In fact, it made me curious when I found out somebody died in front of my house. You know, it was like, oh, there's, I don't know. Sometimes they'd leave the cars there overnight until the tow trucks came. And, you know, I'd look at this thing with wonder because this horrible thing happened in it. And I've always just sort of gravitated towards that. When we were growing up, I grew up in like a Catholic home and cemeteries. I went to funerals since I was a kid, and seeing embalmed bodies was always fascinating to me. And we were, you know, cemeteries are sort of these solemn places that we hardly ever went to. And I gravitated towards them. I thought they'd be really interesting. I wasn't goth. It wasn't like that. I was just, you wouldn't tell me from any other kid probably, but I just, you know, gravitated towards those sort of more darker things. The people I knew who were murdered, I went to go see where they got murdered. I wanted to see it. You know, it wasn't lighting candles. It wasn't like that. It was just genuinely as a spectator.
If I recall, in one of your YouTube videos, you talked a little bit about the dangerous junction that you grew up on. Am I right in that you recalled how, as a child, your mother used to collect broken glass and artifacts from car crashes and make mosaics and art from the pieces? Is that right?
Yeah, and it wasn't like my mom was this edgy artist who, you know, it wasn't like that. She just, you know, she liked to paint. She just did it as a hobby because she was stuck at home with all of us kids. So it's just sort of an outlet for her. She liked drawing and things like that. And she made a mosaic of the Three Kings for Christmas. And it was all made from glass from accidents. And it wasn't, you know, it was just something she did. Probably in retrospect, she'd, you know, be horrified. She wasn't horrified when they started mentioning it out loud. It just sort of took away that mystique. And also, you know, I started, you know, collecting souvenirs of my own from those sorts of things. Again, it was just, I was exposed to it. It didn't really bother me. In fact, you know, these artifacts, this glass came from something where something terrible happened and my mom made something really cool out of it. So again, it sounds like she's, you know, wore a beret and a stripy shirt and was like painting. It wasn't like that, you know, it was just my mom in Detroit and as a hobby, and that's all.
So I suppose you could say that growing up, death was a part of life for you. Death was all around you and you didn't see it as anything macabre or to shy away from then.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, other people thought it was, so maybe that attracted me more.
Scott, what do you find is the most difficult aspect in encouraging people to engage with you about certain matters that they may not wish to speak about? For example, you might visit a location and more often than not, there are individuals there who may not be comfortable talking about the location's dark past, shall we say?
Yeah. Well, generally, people know what they're signing up for when they move into some place or some place notorious happened. Now, California has an odd law that an estate agent is only legally obligated to tell somebody if something horrible happened in their house for a period of 3 years. So even if it is the Manson murders, or, you know, I'll just pull a name out, John Wayne Gacy, even though that was Illinois, they don't have to tell you after 3 years. But I would also say, if you're going to buy a house, you'd be a fool not to Google it first. You know, that would be sort of silly. But generally, the people who own places, homes, where things like that have happened, are usually expected. You know, they're before the internet, there didn't used to be crowds there. You know, it wasn't like that before. But it's the neighbors, you know, that had the problem with it. You know, people come out and yell at you, and very, very, very rarely, but it has happened a few times over my life, that people say, "Get the hell out, you ghouls." And, you know, but now there's, I always say that there's 100 true crime networks on television. Back then, we were kind of doing it under, you know, under cloak, you know, kind of doing it at nighttime to see if we could get away with it unnoticed. And now people are just brazen with their cameras, and, you know, a lot of times just hopping fences, which we used to do, honestly, but we were trying to be more discreet about it, to get a look at where something, you know, happened.
So how long have you been into dark history and macabre tourism, Scott? Is it since your childhood, or is it something that you developed in your more adult years?
Well, probably since I was a kid. You know, there was a legend. I think almost every neighborhood growing up here has a weird legend of the crazy old lady that, you know, killed her husband with an axe or something like that. You know, and that was one by my house. And we used to ride our little bikes over there when we were kids to see it, you know. So, and then when I moved to Chicago, that's when I started getting a little bit more into the famous stuff, you know, because we didn't have that much famous stuff in Detroit at that point. So Chicago, I got more interested in, and Dahmer happened. And I guess that's where my interest in killings, murders went. That came about. I mean, the famous stuff, do you know what I mean? Like Dahmer and things like that. Before, I went because I had sort of a personal thing with it. And then it became more of a tourism thing. But then as I was doing that, the newspapers were getting more sensational, as were the newscasts. So they did become, you know, tourist destinations.
You touched briefly on Jeffrey Dahmer just then, Scott. When you lived in Chicago, was that at roughly the same time of the murders? I know that some happened very close to where you were at the time.
I know it was because, you know, I used to go to a lot of the bars, and there was a certain area, and Dahmer used to hang out at those bars. There was a restaurant that I know one of the kids who was killed. I mean, I didn't know him, but I knew I knew his dad owned the restaurant. He was a waiter there. So there it did sort of touch in an odd way. But Dahmer was also really, it was really weird. I'm laughing, like, it's not funny, but Dahmer used to pick kids up, you know, guys up in this area of, they call it Boys Town, I think. And he'd take a bus back to Milwaukee, like an hour, you know, so there's not a whole lot of people that would, you know, meet a guy and go, you know, get on a bus for an hour to go to Milwaukee. So I think it was, the selection was rather, in Chicago, rather limited, you know, as far as people that would sign up for that. But it was around. It was around. And Gacy, you know, he was around too. But that was way before my time. But the bars he used to he'd go to every so often were places I went to.
I would imagine that would give you a weird vibe, no? The thought of being that close to something and knowing that there is a chance, no matter how large or slim, that you could have been closer to the murders than you may have known. Does that give you a strange feel or a sense of close call?
I'll always do a sweeping look and think, wow, this is where it happened. But mostly I was just concerned with drinking at that point, you know. but you know, you pass by, and if somebody is visiting from out of town, oh, there's Little Jim's bar, and that's where Dahmer used to hang out, and, you know, so it was always there. It wasn't something I concentrated on, but certainly, and I went to certain places because of its notorious history. Like when I lived in the East End of London for several years, and I always went to the Blind Beggar, you know, and a couple of the Cray Twins' other pubs, and, you know, it just made it more of an attraction to me. It was fascinating. And yeah, every once in a while you kind of look around and think, this crazy, you know, terrible event happened, and here I am sitting in it, and you still can, and I love that.
You were living in London, if memory serves, when the tragic death of Princess Diana played out. Is that right? What was it like being an American in London at that time?
Well, that was, you know, it's funny because I was visiting family in Detroit, and when it came about, when the news came about, and then I don't know, a day or so later, they announced the funeral. It's like, oh, I am not missing this. So I went back, and you know, going back, leaving from Heathrow, because there's hardly any traffic, so we took a taxi. You know, it was rather expensive, but it was nice because you're driving past Westminster and places like that, and it's just people on every side and hardly any traffic. It was like nothing else. I mean, you know that it was insanity. I mean, these insanity. People don't generally in Britain express themselves in that way, you know, and so that over the top, I think it's the first time somebody told me it gave people permission to grieve or something like that for the first time. So the outpouring was absolutely insane. Well, to go to Kensington Palace and see those flowers almost hitting the road was absolutely crazy. So it was a very surreal thing. And then going to see the coffin go by in the gun carriage. And everyone else was heading towards Westminster Abbey and following her. We went, got on the train and got home. And you know, we're walking down Bethnal Green Road, and it was a beautiful day, as you probably remember, and not a single car on the road. And everyone had their windows open, and you could hear Elton John singing down the road. And it was just the most, it was a very impactful moment. You know, I didn't know her. She wasn't my princess. You know what I mean? We Americans loved her because she was, you know, star quality, etc. But it was really something else. And then I was there while Princess Margaret died. There's a little patch about 5x5 in front of Kensington Palace, which only her charities left flowers for. Yeah, that was kind of funny. Oh, but my bookend was the Queen Mother, so that was a good way to go out, you know, with the planes and everything. That was gorgeous. It really was.
Well, personally, I don't quite understand the obsession with royalty that many of my country folks seem to share. Maybe I'm of the wrong generation, I guess.
So there's a bit of, you know, and Americans are obsessed with that. They are, you know, our movie stars are our royal family. So, you know, everyone's eating up all the Harry, Meghan, all that stuff. So, yeah, they are superstars in our eyes. And I remember going to England, and this was back in, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s, when they used to publish in the London Times all the royal engagements. So, you know, it said, well, the Queen's going to be at such and such a place. And I'm like, okay, let's go see the Queen. And it was like unreal to see him actually moving and talking and meeting people. And that was really, I just couldn't grasp that comment because, or that idea, because they're always just still images. And it was something else. It was a real thrill.
Touching back on true crime then, why do you think the interest and obsession with true crime is stronger now than it ever has been? What do you think has changed, Scott?
That's such a bizarre thing. I can't quite figure that out, except that people have always known there's been looky-loos. It was probably the turning point was O.J. Simpson, I think, because that's when they were broadcasting it every day for hours a day. And there were television specials. I remember in Britain they had them, you know. They'd have, like, nightly 30-minute recaps of the trial. And then that made it unreal. You know, that made it into a story rather than news. And I think that was the turning point. You know, they started publishing books about that. And before, you know, true crime magazines, there were like two of them, and they were all in the very back of the magazine racks when you went to the stores, you know. So that, I think the O.J. Simpson case is the one that changed everything. I do.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree with you on that, Scott. I remember the O.J. case, and particularly the car chase more than anything. I remember saying to my brother at the time, wow, America do this thing where all the channels cut to a car chase when there's a criminal on the loose. It was fascinating to me as a teenager, especially as we don't really have that here in the UK. I thought it was great, though. It was like a real-life movie playing out.
No, it is weird. And then if the chases end horribly, which everyone hopes they do, because that's the whole point. You want to see how it ends. And then they turn away really quick. They say, oh, we can't show you that because it's too awful. And it's like, no, hang on. You've just been baiting us for the last 10 minutes. Well, at least let us see the end of it. You know, it's terrible, but there you are. It's like chewing, you know, it's like popcorn. You're waiting and waiting. And there's the climax. Don't you dare cut away. They do.
That's so true, actually. While I was preparing for our phone call today, Scott, I went on YouTube and I watched an old episode of Sally, Jesse, Raphael from back in, I think it was September 1993. The subject of the show was people who had a fascination with serial killers. It was the episode that featured Hart Fisher of Boneyard Press and Gerard Way years before he started My Chemical Romance. The individuals it featured on the show, by today's standards, just seemed like your average true crime fans. But the audience at the time, well, they seem horrified and offended by their interest, though.
Yeah, I mean, and then back then it took a whole lot more effort because, you know, nowadays, I mean, I just on a whim one day, I emailed Bobby Beausoleil a question who was, you know, part of the whole Manson family, and he emailed me back within a day. There's like an access that you have to them. Back then, it took work. You know, you had to find the address, and then I would imagine those people get all sorts of mail every day. I know that Manson, you know, just had his people, you know, that were on his cell row, you know, answering mail for him because he didn't want to be bothered with it. You know, there's an element. I don't understand the Ramirez thing because I look at his face and it scares me. It really does. But I think that women are attracted to the fame. And I think that they're attracted to, like, I can see Bundy. Bundy was a good looking guy. And I could see how they would be attracted to that. And they don't have to have any physical contact with them. You know, there's no, you know, maybe that's their thing, is that they can't ever get together in that way. And that gives them sort of safety in that way. I'm guessing anyway. But it is odd, especially back then. It was put on there for shock value, of course. Sally, Jesse, Raphael, that's what they all did. Jerry Springer and all those people. In fact, the first time I met Jerry Springer was at Nicole Simpson's house. My sister and I took her there on a Sunday morning, and we were going there to see the Gates, and Jerry Springer was there with one other person. It's like, oh, hey, you know, that was weird. But anyway, I do think that there's an element of closeness without there having to be physical closeness and fame, you know, notoriety.
Do you consider what you do and the things that you document to be exploitative in any way? Or is it a positive process in your view? Have you ever received backlash for your interests, and how do you deal with that, Scott?
Surprisingly little backlash. In fact, it's odd that it's sort of become, my work has sort of become celebrated in a weird way because, you know, I started doing my website, Find It Death, back when the internet was still young. I remember I bought the domain in 98 and started it then, and no one else was doing that. In fact, I had to scan in pictures of like Myra Hindley and stuff like that because there were none on the internet at that point, or they weren't easy to find. There was no Google back then. So, of course, there's always going to be a bit of a backlash. You know, I'll get a nasty comment or a nasty email, but I've never had anything, you know, crazy happen to me that I can think of. You know, I've had people threaten me, but, you know, it's just comments. It's stupid comments. There is an element of exploitation to it. Absolutely. Anyone who writes a book or a magazine article or, no disrespect, a podcast, it is exploitative. How you want to handle that is a totally different thing. There was a time when I would write serial killers. I wrote Gacy. I wrote Myra Hindley. I wrote Rose West. I wrote Reggie Cray. And actually, he and I, you know, kind of corresponded a little bit. But it was I wouldn't go so far as to do that now. Crays didn't bother me so much because they dealt with themselves. You know what I mean? It's like they didn't go crawling in windows and killing people that they didn't know. And I can't justify that as being a good thing or not, but I just, there's a romance to them that I don't find with the others. I wrote Tex Watts and I got a response from Tex Watts. Would I do that now? No, because I'm much more oriented towards victims anymore. And there was a time when I was really snarky and I would make jokes, and maybe I will privately, but I wouldn't do that because I take what I do seriously now. And yeah, there's always going to be a cheap joke sometimes, but no, I there is absolutely an element of exploitation, but I try to use that in a more positive way than I did in the past.
Obviously, there are others on the internet who create true crime and dark history content. But one of the reasons I follow your work, Scott, and have done for almost 10 years now, is because of the respectful way that you approach it and how specifically your content doesn't feel exploitative to me in any way. What I find distasteful are those content creators who try to capitalize on the crimes and fit their name into the narrative of the crime story somehow. Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, it's about me, and that's what I've always said. I mean, of course, there's always going to be an element of me because I'm the face of it, and people, you know, come to me and talk to me or ask me questions, and I provide a service when I did with the tour and things like that. So, but it's never been about me. And that's one thing I like the people that are interested in the, you know, the Tate-LaBianca murders or the Manson murders, as they're referred to. There are like maybe five or four cliques or clusters of people who study it daily. I mean, it's on their minds daily, and they all hate each other. You know, it's sort of like you can know a lot, but if you claim you're going to know more than me, I'm coming for you. You're the enemy, you know? And it's always like, I discovered this first. And it's like, who cares, really? You know, the fact is, whatever that is information that's out now. But people are so possessive of it. And it's exhausting, really, because this is really about 7+ people that have been murdered back in 1969. So I find that really tiresome. I do. And I try to stay away from that. Maybe I'll hang around in the background and listen in, because I get information, you know, it's interesting. I take what I can from it, then I can learn. But when it comes to personally being involved like that, you know, yeah, I have a problem.
I'm glad you touched on Charles Manson there, Scott. One of the first tours I took with your dearly departed tour company in LA was the Manson-themed Helter Skelter tour. I enjoyed it so much because it was jam-packed with facts and information, but also because it focused on the victims. In my research of the Manson case over the years, I found that many other experts or Manson family researchers seem to hold Manson himself in high regard and focus their attention on him and his family of criminals. It's almost like they want to be one of the family. Have you found that?
There's a lot of that. Yeah. Right. Yeah. My tour, I mean, I don't know. People, you know, ask me a lot about sort of minor members that were in the Manson family. And I lose interest when it gets away from the actual homicides, because that's what I'm interested in. I don't care what made, well, Manson is different. Philosophies or whatever it is that prompted all this to go on was a pretty fascinating time. But generally, yeah, I liked the Manson tour, the Helter Skelter tour, because it showed the victims where they lived, where they worked. And Manson, of course, is a part of that. Manson was a part of that. You know, Manson, you know, knew most of these people, we'll say. And so, you know, you go to the Whiskey a Go-Go on the Sunset Strip, and, you know, J.C. Sebring and Sharon Tate used to dance there, and it was a very hip hangout, and so did Manson, you know, so it's all intertwined. And also was a huge effect on pop culture that a lot of people, you know, don't really, you know, realize. There was a lot of elements of pop culture involved with the movie stars and the rock stars and all that kind of business. So there's nothing like it. There's really nothing like it. That's why I'm obsessed with it, I guess.
I think that was going to be my next question, actually. But in the time I've been following your work, it's Manson and the Tate-LaBianca murders that stands out as your real area of expertise. No one knows the case and events better than you do, in my opinion. But what was it that got you so interested in the case and the crimes themselves, Scott?
Yeah, it was seeing in 1976 the movie Helter Skelter. Manson, they made into be this... you know, this haunted, we would call it a boogeyman. I think you call it a bogeyman there, but I mean, don't you? Isn't that what you call it?
Like, yes.
Made him into this, and he was a frightening individual. And those crazy eyes that were on the cover of every magazine, you know, Manson knew that he didn't have a chance. I mean, Manson was 5'4" or something like that. He was, you know, he had a big mouth and he was charming and he got people to follow him and do those things. But yeah, he was not an intimidating man, but that made him intimidating. And he stepped up because he knew that was going to happen. He knew he had no chance of getting out. So anytime he did an interview, he was always doing that woo-woo, because he knew. And he was also, if he didn't act crazy, he'd be eaten alive in prison. So he acted it the whole time, and it freaked people out. So, but anyway, back to the original exposure to him, it was that movie in 1976. And also the fact that those people, you know, were just going about their daily lives. And what terrified me the most, I think, was Abigail Folger, because she was laying in bed reading a book. And this woman walked into her bedroom, and within 30 minutes, she was dead on the front lawn with 28 stab wounds. The absolute randomness of it, it was so terrifying to me that you were no longer safe in your own bed. And that was a real moving moment for me. And that's what cinched it.
What about Manson himself then, Scott? Many of his defenders say that he didn't actually kill anybody himself, even though he actually did if you research his background. But they will say that he should never have been treated as harshly as he was, that it was his followers who committed the murders on the weekend of August 8th and 9th, 1969. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, if you're convicted on physical crimes, you know, which is... You know, Manson tried to kill people. We know that. So it's quite likely he probably did kill someone at some point in his life. But as far as those murders, you know, he did participate twice. He did, you know, hit Gary Heyman in the head with a machete and cut open his head. He did hit Shorty Shea in the back of the head with an axe. So in that regard, he's as guilty as the rest of them, I think, without, you know, raising a knife on those two nights. But Manson knew how to get things done, which is how they got him on conspiracy. You know, you when he said things like, you know what to do, you know, well, you go up there and you do what you have to do to get the money. Manson knew what was going to happen without saying what was going to happen. So did Manson kill anyone on those two nights? No, he didn't. Was he responsible? Some would argue, but I would say, you know, fairly responsible, yes. Not knife to flesh responsible, but influence wise, yeah, I think responsible.
Do you buy Vincent Bugliosi's Helter Skelter theory on order of events?
I think most people were really married to that story of Helter Skelter and the race war and all that kind of business. And it wasn't the case that, you know, there was an element that I always compare it to the play Mamma Mia, because those people took 20 ABBA songs and made it into a plot, a very loose, poor plot. And that's what Vincent Bugliosi did. He took all these elements that were there, the Beatles' White Album, the Helter Skelter door, and, you know, and the pig stuff. And he just sort of wove this scenario. There was an element of that. There was an element of racism, and there was an element of Helter Skelter. He used the term, but it wasn't concentrated upon like it will, you know, like it's been portrayed. But I was entranced by that story, which is what Vincent Bugliosi wanted people to do. He was using fear. And then he did what he had to do. That's all he had to do. He didn't had to prove why anybody did anything. He just had to prove that they did it. And he did, you know, using a lot of information. But it was a horror movie that he had created. And because the real stuff is very boring. You know, like the O.J. Simpson thing, when they were like DNA, DNA, DNA for weeks. You know, if you're talking about drugs and drugs and biker gangs and drugs and drugs and biker gangs and robberies, you know, it would get really tedious. So let's do this. Let's make it into this. And all those elements were true. He just waved a really, created a really, you know, fantastical story.
Do you, with all your knowledge and research on the subject, have a different theory?
Well, yeah, I mean, I do believe in the drugs, and I do believe that those people knew each other. And I don't know, I have, when it comes to the Tate House, you know, Tex Watson, I think, had a history with Wojciech Frykowski. And Tex Watson, you know, he was Charlie's, I'm not going to say he was his right-hand man, but he was Charlie's goon. And he was like a monster. He killed six of those seven people on those two nights. He was out of control. And I think Manson knew that. But I think that possibly Tex Watson had a relationship that wasn't good with Wojciech Frykowski. I think he was the main focus of that night when they went out there, and it just went out of control. He basically kicked Wojciech Frykowski and said, "I'm the devil and I'm here to do the devil's business." That is pretty, I think he knew what was going on at that point. And Wojciech Frykowski, think Abigail Folger was stabbed 28 times, Sharon Tate 16 times, J.C. Brings 7 times and shot once. Wojciech Frykowski was shot twice, stabbed 51 times, and then beaten so hard with a knife with a gun that it broke on his head. So I think it was more personal, and I do think it had to do with drugs and money more than anything else. And the LaBiancas the next night, that's a whole different story. I believe that Manson and the others were associated socially with one of the family members of the LaBiancas, and I think that's sort of what prompted it all.
I was going to mention that link, actually, without specifically mentioning her name, as I believe that person is still alive. But as I understand and have found out, there was an individual in the LaBianca family who was associated, prior to the murders, with Tex Watson, and even supported and petitioned for his release throughout the 1990s. Is that correct, Scott?
Yes, that's right. That's right. And that woman lived with a biker who used to hang out at the Spahn Ranch. And, so there's, I I'll just say her name. I'm not saying anything that's against, I'm not slandering her. But I know for a fact that at least post the murders, Susan, who is Mrs. LaBianca's daughter, was supporting Tex Watson's release. And there's one report that Tex lived right around the corner. That's published in a book. So I'm just giving you information that I've read. And we know that her boyfriend hung out at the Spahn Ranch. So it's just a little bit too coincidental for me. And she was never really interviewed properly about the situation.
I am just going to drop in here and clarify that the individual that me and Scott are talking about is named Suzanne LaBerge, or also known as Suzanne Struthers. She was Rosemary LaBianca's daughter, and like Scott said, it has been mentioned in a number of publications over the years who she was associated with at the time of the Tate LaBianca murders, and also what her unusual activities in the years after the imprisonment of the Manson family were. Anyway, let's get back to the conversation. Okay, so moving on from Manson, as I don't want to make your interview all about him. From your time working in Hollywood and from your previous life over in the UK, you've had the opportunity to meet a lot of A-list celebrities. Scott, what would you say was the most interesting or unusual celebrity encounter that you've had?
That's a really good question. I'm trying to think. I mean, I met a lot of old timers, like Jimmy Stewart and George Burns and Dean Martin. In fact, that would probably be my answer would be Dean Martin, because I kind of manipulated the situation so I could meet him. And because he used to, there was a restaurant he used to go to every Sunday afternoon, and he'd sit in the same chair, the same table, and order the same thing every Sunday. So we would go up and I'd show people Dean Martin. We never bothered him or anything, but I go, "Look, there's Dean Martin." It was really cool. And then one day I decided I wanted to meet him, so I chose a seat at the bar that was blocking his view of the game, which he was watching, and it worked. And he came over and tapped me on the shoulder and asked me to move, sent me a beer, and I went over and spoke to him. And that was kind of a fun interaction. I had an odd evening with Roger Moore, where he was, it was with his entire family and dinner, and he was a practical joker, and he had a machine that made fart noises, and he'd hide them behind people and make, and they were just, the family was dying. It was a very, very weird situation. Roger Moore and the fart machine. So, I've had some pretty fascinating interactions with people, you know, it's just been an interesting, but I've always pursued it, you know, and it was hardly ever an accident that these things happened, you know, when I met people, it's because usually because I wanted to, or the situation came about that I knew it was going to happen. But it was never anyone, it's hardly ever running into somebody.
You used to also attend the autograph shows back in the 90s, I understand, didn't you? Were there any celebrities that were not so nice, maybe? And you don't have to mention any specific names if you don't want to.
No, I don't care. I mean, it doesn't bother me. They're my stories. I can tell them. And I can't think of anyone who was super rude. I didn't think of Billy Zane as the one who was an absolute dick a couple of times. So I'm not, like, making that up. There are people that I know weren't interested to talk to me about what I, the things I wanted to talk about. That's you know, that somebody said, like, Leslie Van Houten, who was in the Manson family, who was released recently, they said, do you want to talk to her? It's like, well, not really, because I can't learn anything from her. And she'd probably not want to talk to me about the things I want to talk about. So I've worked with people, I've met people that knew Jane Mansfield. And when I mentioned that I have the car that she was killed in, they kind of, we don't want to talk to you kind of a thing. But then, you know, some people were really receptive to that kind of thing too. So it just depended. But I've never had any super negative reactions when I brought things up. It was just it was clear some people just didn't like me or didn't want to talk about the things I wanted to talk about.
I've heard that David Spade is a notorious asshole. Hasn't he shouted abuse and thrown things at your tour bus a few times?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, whatever. You got nothing better to do than cash those checks and throw rocks over your fence at people. Yeah, I wasn't impressed with David Spade. But, you know, it made for a funny story. I wish I could remember more because I know I've got good stories, but I can't think of any more off the top of my head. I used to have a list. I kept like a whole list of all the people I've met and the interactions I've had, but I haven't found that list in a long time. But it's been pretty interesting.
You briefly mentioned there, Scott, that you have the car that Jane Mansfield was tragically killed in. I've seen it myself in your museum. I know that you also own pieces of Rock Hudson's bed, Marilyn Monroe's clothing, crime scene tape from the O.J. Simpson murder scene, grass from the grassy knoll where JFK was killed, and a huge ton more of tragical history items. What would you say is your favorite item that you've collected over the years?
It would certainly be the car, you know, because I was, there was a book that came out in the 60s called Hollywood Babylon that had pictures of the car in it, and I was just mesmerized by it.
Happy right there.
Growing up, it was a fascinating thing, and then to be in the room with it was another thing, and then when it became available to us, that was like, wow, we couldn't really hesitate to do that, to get that. So that was probably it. The other stuff is kind of fun. I mean, we own, you know, Mae West's teeth, Herb Dentures. You know, it's like, well, all right, I think it's funny. A tile from the pool that Brian Jones drowned in, you know, that's in the news right now because it's an Airbnb now, I think, in Cotchford, I think is the name of the place. But yeah, so you know, that's the kind of, it's funny, somebody just sent me, this is carpeting from Karen Carpenter's music room, you know? So a lot of the Carpenter's songs, you know, were composed on this carpet, you know? It just, to anyone else, it's just garbage, you know, just silly things. But when you're looking at it all in one place, that makes it more, it's funny. You can't take it that seriously, but on the other hand, it's, you know, it's important stuff to pop culture. A cigarette butt from a movie star, but when you see it next to the Carpenter's carpet, it's funny. The Carpenters, I just got that.
Your museum had to close due to COVID-19 and all that came with that, but do you think you will ever reopen the museum again, even though I know that you've now relocated to Palm Springs?
I hope so, because we're paying an extortionate amount of money to keep it stored away, so I certainly hope so. We just haven't decided on an actual place for it yet, but I'd certainly, you know, like to, because it's too fun to keep to myself, you know. It's so much fun to share it with people, and you know, as I said, we don't take it that seriously, but then it's what we do, we take it seriously, you know. We don't, it's not like we don't mock, you know, we we celebrate these people, and everyone's walked on a piece of carpeting, but this carpeting is different. So yeah, I don't try to convince anybody. If you get it, you get it. If you don't, you really don't get it. That's fine.
Scott, I can officially say I get it. I too am a collector and have letters from serial killers and trinkets from controversial locations. I even have my own cabinet of curiosities that people either find fascinating or utterly macabre. You were even kind enough to gift me, if you remember, some grass from the location of the second gunman on the grassy knoll the last time I was over, and I truly value it being the JFK conspiracy nut that I am. But my question is, where do you think the location of your new museum will be? Back in LA? Or are you done with that city now?
I'm done with Los Angeles. As far as I'm not, and that sounds like I'm being a victim, but I didn't feel very appreciated there. And also, you know, our museum was an addition to a tour company, and it made it very difficult. It was too expensive, and I spent most of my time doing things I didn't want to do. And probably what I really loved doing, which is showing people cool things, was about 10% of what I was doing. It had to deal with neighbors that were angry about tour buses coming around. You had to deal with the government wanting to tax things. You have to go through mechanics to, you know, it was just one thing after the other. And then you have employees, and then you have to pay for their insurance, and you have to have the building and its insurance. And it was joyless. It really was. And so putting things away in storage for the time being felt really good, because I don't have all that responsibility hanging over my head. So now, hopefully, when we do it next, it'll be a positive experience.
So what can we expect from you and your content coming up, Scott? What have you got in store for us on the YouTube channel? And when can we expect another episode of your Dearly Departed podcast?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, it's funny because Mike, my co-pilot on the podcast, has just spent a lot of time in the Ukraine and doing a documentary. And I think he's doing something he didn't really talk about a whole lot with me, because I guess he's got to keep things under wraps. But I think he said something about something on dark tourism. But we just haven't had an opportunity to get together and do that. So it's not off the table. It's just really difficult to commit to a certain time for us, but it's certainly overdue. And the YouTube stuff is just all over the place. And gets the problem. I'm overwhelmed by it, because there's so many different things that I could be doing, and it's easier just to go, just not going to do it. But I do have a lot of things around me that I'm going to focus on. We had just had an iconic quiz show host died the other day, so I went and dug out a picture of him.
Would that be Bob Barker? I think I heard about that.
And it's just, you know, it's the stuff that comes up. True crime, that stuff people like, and I've been doing these videos like 5 or 6 per episode. One I'm working on right now, there was an actress named she's in a show called iCarly.
Do you mean Miranda Cosgrove?
I don't, Miranda Cosgrove. I don't even know who she is, to be honest with you, but she's young and very, you know, young people are interested in her. But she had a stalker, and the stalker was in front of her house for like 7 hours one day. And then he got so frustrated waiting for her, he shot at a passing motorist, just shot, and then lit himself on fire in front of her house. It's like, oh my God, what an insane story. But yeah, he just lit himself on fire. So, you know, stories like that are so absolutely insane. And the amount of just normal, just people living in Hollywood, you know, cutting each other's heads off there's an inordinate amount of that. And but it's fascinating, isn't it? Because that was, again, it was like the, you'll look a second time if you're passing a shop and you see, you know, garbage bins in front of it, and you think, oh, for instance, say Fred West used to dump things in there. Every time you pass that, you go, I'm going to look at that, because you think about it, you know, and that's sort of the way things are, you know, and those are the things that you pass every day, which makes it so interesting to me anyway. And then apparently, you know, to others.
Man, this type of stuff is so uniquely Los Angeles, isn't it? Every time I'm over, something quite literally insane is happening. But living there, wow, I can't imagine.
very happy to leave. You know, I mean, I'll go into LA and stay in LA for 2 nights, and then I'm like, okay, I'm done here. You know, too many people and too much. I don't know. I like my elbow room now. So but I do like going back and seeing things. It's it is a wonderland for awful things.
A wonderland for awful things. Quite possibly the perfect analogy for Los Angeles and the perfect note to end on tonight. Sadly, we've run out of time, but Scott, please keep doing what you do and please keep being you. I find your work, your nature, your sense of humor and content absolutely second to none. Until we speak again, my friend.
Thanks. Thank you. And thanks for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
No problem. All the best.
Take care. Bye-bye.
I highly encourage you all to check out Scott's online content. I honestly lose hours of my life, although I consider it very well spent, watching his videos and taking part in his live chats. The man has no end of interesting stories and information. So for all of Scott's socials and online content, head over to www.deadsoulspodcast.com/darktourism, and I've accumulated everything in one place for you. I could spend so much time talking with Scott, and we will definitely have him back on the show again. So for all of you looking for gossip on his time working for Quentin Tarantino or Zach Bagans, or his anecdotes about life in Hollywood amongst the scandals and celebrity dead, stick with us and we'll ask him back sometime soon. Thank you for everyone who listened tonight. I appreciate you all, and I'm always thankful for those of you who keep coming back week after week. Good night.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.